This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the New Yorker Hour. Crime is something we hear about on the radio, on TV, in political advertising, but usually it's the big deal events, the big ticket art steals, the embezzlements, Ponzi schemes, bribes, and such. In the March 25th issue of The New Yorker, we have something a bit different. The crime rings, stealing everything from purses to power tools. In Los Angeles, a task force of detectives is battling organized retail theft, in which boosted goods often end up for sale online or commingled with store shelves with legitimate items. A dozen detectives from the California Highway Patrol gathered in a Los Angeles area parking lot the other morning for an operational briefing. In about 20 minutes, they would drive to a nearby Home Depot, where customers were known to regularly wheel carts of merchandise out the door without paying and to stick power tools down their pants. The investigators had planned a night-long blitz. Surveillance, arrest, repeat. Anyone caught stealing would be handcuffed, led to a back room, and questioned. What did you plan to do with these items? Did you take them on behalf of someone else? The goal was not to micro-police shoplifting, but to discover and disrupt networks engaged in organized retail crime, a burgeoning area of criminal investigation. A booster is a professional thief who typically sells to a fence, someone who resells stolen materials. A fence may buy a $100 drill from a booster for $30 to resell it for $60, or he may pay in drugs. In sworn testimony before House Committee on Homeland Security, Scott Glenn, Home Depot's Vice President of Asset Protection, recently accused criminal organizations of recruiting vulnerable people into retail theft schemes by preying on their need for fast cash or for fentanyl. A fence may unload boosted goods at a swap meet or at a store where illicit items are washed by commingling them with legitimate ones. Pilfered commodities often wind up online. Early in the pandemic, the pivot to e-commerce yielded new players eager to exploit the rogue freedoms of under-regulated commercial spaces. Amazon, eBay, OfferUp, Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace. All bizarre land. The detectives in the parking lot, who were detailed to or working with the Highway Patrol's Organized Retail Crime Task Force, had been trying to keep up. Captain Jeff Lofton heads a group of investigative units with the CHP's Southern Division. He told me, if we could just get back to the days when we were dealing with career criminals, it would be more manageable. Now we're having to deal with everybody and their brother, and trying to find out who they are. In the parking lot, Tom Probart, a bushily mustachioed detective in his 30s, distributed maps of the Home Depot's layout and exits. Suspects rarely flee through gardening, he told the other officers. The store's back door opened to a high wall, leaving the main entrance and lumber as the thieves' likelier choices of egress. Probart pronounced lumber as lumbar, and his colleagues immediately gave him the appropriate amount of shit. A two-officer takedown team would make arrests the moment a suspect left the store. "Let's get them right away," the task force supervisor, Sergeant Jimmy Eberhardt, a soft-spoken professionalist with a goatee and tattoo sleeves, told the officers. Foot pursuits and physical harm could be prevented with the element of surprise, being on top of these guys before they even know we're there. On the edge of the briefing circle stood half a dozen young men. One was wearing a sports jersey, another a Mickey Mouse sweatshirt. "Don't mistake them for suspects," Probart cautioned the CHP detectives. The men were Home Depot Loss Prevention Employees, LPs, whose job is to prevent and investigate theft. LPs are not law enforcement officers, though some used to be, and they have no arrest powers. In fact, a Home Depot employee can be fired for intervening in a theft. A company spokesman has said, "No merchandise or other asset is worth risking the life of our associates or customers, which is why we have a strict policy against pursuing a shoplifter in a manner that creates a safety risk for anyone." Yet many organized retail crime investigations start with an LP who, like a private eye, may build a case by logging thefts, compiling names, taking photographs, and covertly following suspects around town. An energetic young LP shared with the task force members a snapshot of a known booster who favored plumbing supplies and said, "He really likes this store." At the Home Depot, some of the undercover officers waited behind the tinted windows of their unmarked Nissans and Jeeps. Others went inside. Detective Amy Rodriguez, wearing skinny jeans and her hair in a sleek ponytail, strolled through the front door like a bored teenager, sipping from an In-N-Out burger cup. A stubbled career detective named Cap, who was known for edging daringly close to surveilled subjects, wore a plaid flannel over a faded T-shirt. He told me, "If we were going to Beverly Hills or Macy's, I'd probably dress a little differently." "Yeah, no," Eberhardt said later. "Cap always dresses like that." To the average person, the investigators would appear to be everyday shoppers, pondering paint chips or toilets. Rodriguez and Probart slipped into a cramped office to monitor surveillance feeds and to run comms. The officers were carrying department-issued radios, and everyone was using a cell phone app that allowed them to relay observations discreetly via earbuds. With each app message, Eberhard, parked outside in a Ram truck, heard a noirish crime. His police radio dribbled tip-offs. "Black hat, black jacket, main entrance. Backward Dodger hat. Two white male adults opening packages." The detectives and the LPs, both of whose teams were racially diverse, singled out subjects based on telltale behavior. A booster may pace or glance around a lot. He may park too close to the entrance, carry an oddly large bag, or wear an unseasonably heavy coat. At some blitzes, investigators may catch a dozen people or more. Over the course of this operation, they nabbed 8. A detective would say, "Takedown, takedown," and 2 uniformed officers would step out of a hiding place and speak quietly to the man. All of the suspects were men, as they handcuffed them. The store products in his possession were cataloged as evidence and deposited into Home Depot carts to be returned to inventory. Tide detergent, Bounty paper towels, a space heater, a stud detector. Investigators led each subject past fragrant lengths of sawn wood to the interview room, an employee break area. Each arrest took less than 3 minutes. The team would then get back into position. Los Angeles is among the world's largest shopping environments. The metropolitan area's diverse convergence of stores, street markets, warehouses, cargo ships, interstates, freight trains, and luxury goods, along with its wealth disparity, street gangs, and proximity to the Mexican border, make it a singularly conducive to criminal enterprise. During the pandemic, the retail landscape suffered. Now, brick-and-mortar shopping is rebounding. Chanel recently opened a multi-story emporium on Rodeo Drive, its largest store in the United States. Last year, L.A. endured what became known as Flash Rob Summer. On August 1st, nearly a dozen masked people swarmed into a Gucci boutique and fled with armloads of merchandise. On August 8th, at least 30 people snatched more than $300,000 worth of items at an Yves Saint Laurent store and left in a fleet of getaway cars. 4 days later, Sunglass Hut. The same day at a Nordstrom, dozens of people dressed in dark clothes ransacked the designer handbag department, toppling mannequins. Another day at a Nike store, a witness yelled, "Where's security?" while recording a man and a woman calmly filling garbage bags with clothes and shoes before walking out the front door. When Eberhardt teaches other agencies' officers what he has learned about investigating organized retail crime, one of his PowerPoint slides notes a disturbing trend. On social media, outlaw networks recruit employees of retail businesses or credit facilities to, say, steal a customer's identity or knowingly run a pinched credit card. What's more, employees may assist with a theft in what the retail industry calls sweethearting. Before a job, boosters study a store's layout and identify what they want to take. Rip crews, teams of robbers communicating via encrypted apps, often wear hooded clothing, complicating efforts to identify faces. On the ground, they may signal one another audibly. One group mimic bird calls while hitting a Macy's perfume counter in Sherman Oaks. Crews may be fulfilling a shopping list from a fence, who may be fulfilling an order from another criminal operator. The most successful rip crews are focused and undeterred. At the Nordstrom flash rob, the thieves dragged entire metal racks out the door by their security cables. At an Apple store in Fresno, a booster once knocked a Good Samaritan flat as he and several conspirators fled with nearly $30,000 worth of laptops and phones. Flash robbers usually vanish before the police have time to arrive. Videos of these crimes tend to go viral, making flash robberies seem more common than they actually are. A CNBC International clip headlined, "Watch an Apple Store Get Robbed in 12 Seconds," has been viewed 32 million times. In a popular Instagram video of a Nordstrom hit, a woman witnessing the heist yells, "Yo, they wilding the fuck out," and then tells the thieves, "Run, y'all gotta work together." Pointing her lens at a handbag abandoned in the road, still cabled to its stand, she says, "He left a YSL purse, and can I go get the purse?" Online comments about retail theft tend to break down as either anti-crime or anti-capitalist. One person wrote, "They're a billion-dollar company, and y'all are acting like someone robbed your grandma," referring to the assault on Nordstrom. Another responded, "Without stores and jobs, cities will lose income and cut services." "Then you complain because the city isn't picking up trash or repairing the roads or replacing the streetlights." Others are more interested in methodology. "How do 20 people agree to commit crime together? Can't even get my friends to agree on a restaurant." Eberhardt's unit, which focuses on the less showy aspects of organized retail crime, works out of a tight windowless office just north of downtown in an aging fortress shared by homicide detectives and by a squad that reconstructs traffic accidents using advanced math. Eberhardt, who is fastidious by nature, covers his desk in plastic whenever he's away because the ceiling tiles leak. A Batman meme hangs over Rodriguez's corner captioned, "Lie to me again." In any given moment, long tables may be covered in piles of Old Navy jeans or Victoria's Secret bras confiscated in the latest raid. By the time I embedded with the task force in January, the CHP had recovered more than $38 million worth of merchandise and made more than 2,000 arrests in cases involving organized retail crime. The Highway Patrol created the task force in 2019 after California lawmakers codified such thefts as a distinct offense. The law, authored by a Democrat, applies to two or more people working together to steal with the intent to sell, exchange, or return the illicit goods for value, or conspiring to knowingly receive, buy, or possess stolen merchandise. It is also illegal to steal on behalf of someone else and to coordinate and finance such theft. California's Governor Gavin Newsom, also a Democrat, tapped the CHP for the first organized retail crime task force, in part because the agency has statewide authority and because criminal networks exploit the state's jurisdictional mishmash of penalties. During the pandemic, Los Angeles County imposed a zero bail policy for most nonviolent offenders to mitigate mass incarceration. Certain defendants now receive a citation and a court date and are let go. Voters had already elected to raise the monetary threshold for felony theft from $400 to $950. Critics and even suspects have asserted that the combined efforts of these approaches invites crime. Rodriguez told me, "We catch people from the Bay Area and say, 'What are you doing down here?' They'll say, 'I know if I come to L.A., you're just going to give me a ticket.'" Last summer, after Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass announced a new focus on organized retail crime, no Angeleno should feel like it's not safe to go shopping. The district attorney for Orange County, Todd Spitzer, complained that Bass and the L.A. County District Attorney, George Gascon, were contending with a problem that they, as progressives, had helped to create. Spitzer claimed that their stances had resulted in decriminalization, decarceration, and zero bail, which had led to this unrest and emboldened these organized crews. Los Angeles consistently ranks as the city with the worst organized retail crime problem, according to the National Retail Federation, the industry's largest lobbyist organization. In September, Newsom announced the awarding of $267 million in new funding to address the issue. The LAPD and the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department were each promised more than $15 million. Dozens of other cities and counties in California, competing for three-year grants, proposed buying security cameras, license plate readers, computers, and drones. In several jurisdictions, the police plan to conduct retailer training, during which officers may teach employees how to be a good witness or how to fortify their stores. Lieutenant Mike McComas, who runs the LAPD's Organized Retail Crime Task Force, told me, "Shoes are a hot item, so maybe instead of putting out a complete set of shoes, you put out only the right shoe." He added, "Uniformed security, if you can afford it, is great." At Home Depot, I asked Eberhard if he thought that staking out a big box store was a good use of time and funding. The task force has conducted roughly 100 retail blitzes so far. He replied, "I think it's necessary. It's good on several levels. It's good public awareness. Shows what we're doing. We've had people thank us for being out here. We've had people say, 'I have to pay for this stuff, so should they.' It's true. It's also a good deterrent to see us out here. Home Depot likes us because it deters theft and shows that they're not going to just stand down and let people go in there and steal stuff." The Los Angeles County public defender, Ricardo D. Garcia, told me that he objects to the state spending so much taxpayer money on helping businesses and law enforcement while allocating insufficient amounts for public defenders. California is one of the states where counties, not the state itself, are primarily responsible for funding the defense of indigent people. "An influx of arrests," Garcia said, "is going to create more cases for us, and we already are strapped for resources." He observed that a war on drugs type of approach only overfills our jails with people who need help with food, with housing, with medical treatment. And he said, "This mistaken return to a tough-on-crime era undoes decades' worth of good work." One Monday, just before dawn, the task force's detectives pulled up to a bungalow in a residential neighborhood near a freeway. Roosters were crowing. An officer positioned his cruiser in front of the house, blared the siren, and then said via loudspeaker, "This is the California Highway Patrol. We have a search warrant for your residence. Come out with your hands up." The target, a man in his 40s, soon emerged barefoot and scowling and was taken into custody. "We know there's more of you in there," the officer said. Six or seven more people emerged, including a couple of teenagers. The main suspect and a woman were loaded into separate vehicles. The sun rose and we could see a big rig in the driveway and a monster truck with a custom license plate, "Stomp You." The property also had a garage and a shed. The investigators had reason to believe they would discover products that had gone missing from two home supply stores, Florin Decor and Harvard Freight Tools. The search warrant authorized LPs to participate. Once the officers secured the grounds, the LPs moved in with inventory tracking software and a U-Haul. Lofton and I watched from the sidewalk as the LPs dollied out a Predator super quiet inverter generator, Hunter ceiling fans, staple guns, and a 3-ton jack. The detectives know what they were looking for, but never knew what they would find. Lofton recalled a case in which investigators, scrutinizing a suspect's home online, noticed that a Google Street View camera happened to have taken a photograph while the garage door was open. Floor to ceiling, all kinds of power tools. The search of the bungalow yielded about $13,000 worth of allegedly stolen materials, along with an illegal snub-nosed revolver, ammunition, and, in a zippered case on top of a refrigerator, dozens of bundles of cocaine. The detectives hoped to glean valuable information from the suspect. The home improvement items were clearly going somewhere, and had come from somewhere. Boosters sealed from trucks, warehouses, and freight trains, in addition to stores. Internet-savvy criminals were able to maximize supply chain vulnerabilities in part because so much real-time shipping information can be found online. Cargo theft is such a problem that CHP long ago dedicated a specialized unit to it. More than 30% of containerized imports arrive at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. A booster with enough information and chutzpah may present forged documents at a transport point and drive off with an entire load. A lot of that loot goes back overseas. Lofton said, "That's where they're making their money." In the early 2000s, as the Internet became a force multiplier for those looking to anonymously move stolen goods at scale, law enforcement officers began finding illicit truckloads of cigarettes, Advil, Crest White strips. Arrests have been tied to gangs, including MS-13, which was started in L.A. In 2002, an ex-member of MS-13, Brenda Paz, told the authorities about some of her former associates' fencing activities, which have reportedly been linked to transactions involving possible affiliates of Hamas and other international terrorist organizations. Eberhard, who is 50, joined the California Highway Patrol at the age of 21, after toying with the idea of following his father, a prop master at the Carol Burnett Show, into the motion picture industry. Before focusing on organized retail crime, he worked canine and vehicle theft, including 3 years on a complex deep cover operation involving motorcycles. The organized retail crime assignment was thought to be temporary. The task force was initially scheduled to sunset in 2021, but it's been extended to 2026. Eberhard told me, "The amount of theft blew my mind, even being in law enforcement and seeing crime my entire career." Last fall, the CHP detectives became suspicious of a makeup store in East Los Angeles, next door to a cobbler and across the street from a place selling spiritual candles. The cosmetic shop's marquee, the nicest around, showed a fancifully sketched woman with glamorous eyelashes and red lips. Inside, health and beauty products were displayed on glass shelves in attractive pyramids and orderly rows. The shop was active on Facebook and Instagram. The detectives learned that its proprietor also owned a liquidation warehouse, which advertised everything from Victoria's Secret bags to Clinique moisturizer to Born to Glow, a complexion brightener. The proprietor's specialty, according to the business's website, was sourcing makeup and skincare products found in reputable chain stores. The shop's Instagram page showed off a new Tesla and praised Bitcoin as a life-changing game. During searches of the store and the warehouse, officers recovered more than $3 million worth of allegedly stolen items. Much of the haul was tracked to CVS, which Eberhard, before he started working the retail crime beat, had thought of as little more than a place to buy Tylenol. The liquidator, a woman in her late 40s, was charged with a range of felonies. Fences often claim to have made an innocent mistake, but Eberhard believes it is reasonable to expect due diligence from retailers. You're buying off the street. There's no paper trail. You're buying for pennies on the dollar. You don't think it possibly could be stolen? Nobody knows how often these sorts of schemes happen because there are no comprehensive national statistics on organized retail crime. The loosely defined category usually involves a welter of offenses: grand larceny, possession of stolen property, burglary, cybercrime, fraud, which may be defined and prosecuted differently depending on the jurisdiction. Sean Duryea is a California Highway Patrol commissioner. He told me, organized retail crime is not shoplifting where someone's going in and stealing a commodity or food that they need personally. Organized retail crime is greed. When state lawmakers passed organized retail crime legislation, as dozens have done in recent years, they often cite data provided by the NRF, the Retailers Association, which gathers its information through research in an annual survey. The NRF has reported that in 2021, retailers suffered more than $90 billion in shrink, the catch-all term for inventory losses. The organization later had to retract its own stat regarding how much of the shrink involved organized retail crime. It was not nearly half as initially inserted. Estimates now indicate that it was significantly less. Critics use the inaccuracy to characterize the association as the self-serving perpetrator of a hysteria campaign designed to undo criminal justice reforms and justify more police funding. A group called the Center for Just Journalism has accused the news media of abetting an NRF hoax, noting that cops are salivating at the chance to get real money to fight a fake crime wave. Many mainstream news outlets echoed this view. In February, David Johnston, the NRF's vice president of asset protection and retail operations, wrote in an open letter that media coverage that focuses on the known data problems gives many critics an unwarranted excuse to play down the seriousness of these crimes and delay efforts to address them. National shoplifting rates have declined by 7% since 2019, but L.A. is an outlier. Such thefts were up by 76% in the same time period. Retailers have long pushed Congress to pass a federal organized retail crime law, which, by filling data voids, would help clarify the scope of the problem. Last year, Congress did pass the Inform Consumers Act, requiring online marketplaces to collect and verify information on third-party sellers. In a recent congressional hearing on the subject, Summer Steffen, the president-elect of the National District Attorneys Association, told lawmakers that law enforcement first needs to determine the size of the monster. 2 days after the Home Depot blitz, Eberhardt and his detectives drove to an electrical supply store on a dead-end street in East L.A. Numerous American flags flew over the store's rollaway door. The operational handout from the team's 6 a.m. briefing said that the owner was believed to be linked to approximately 30 thefts from Home Depot and Lowe's stores throughout California. There were mugshots of the owner, a white-haired man in his 70s and his circle, all of whom had been under surveillance for weeks. Eberhardt told me, "We already know who our players are." The detectives moved in on an employee as he unlocked the shop. Before long, the owner arrived in the back seat of a CHP cruiser, looking sour. He had been detained in a traffic stop near his home. He claimed to have receipts for the items that a squadron of LPs was stacking in the barricaded street. The proprietor spent the rest of the day sifting through paperwork in his rat's nest of a shop under guard, ultimately producing next to nothing. By nightfall, the street was crowded with apparently hot merchandise. Carbon monoxide detectors, Leviton tamper-resistant outlets, and notably hundreds of heavy spools of copper and electrical wiring, the most expensive of which can retail for more than $700. Rodriguez pointed to some boxed circuit breakers and said, "Those are expensive, too. They're super hard to find, and I know why. They're all here." The next night, Eberhard and I were parked between a hamburger joint and a vacant lot prowled by feral cats. Eberhard slipped his laptop off his dashboard and showed me evidence photographs of devices the thieves and fences used to evade electronic scanners, aluminum-lined chopping bags, and unfastened sensors, talon-like skeleton keys. In a video, we watched a man blowtorch open a plexiglass lockbox at Walgreens. "The tools are constantly evolving," Eberhard said. "The unit's case files show enormous quantities of recovered goods, delta faucets, an unsettling amount of secret deodorant. There were golf clubs and guitars and, somehow, furnaces." When Eberhard came to a photograph of paving stones, he told me about a man who was accused of remodeling an entire house and a restaurant through a long gambit involving unchecked receipts, pickup counters, canceled orders, and extreme gall. The CHP investigation, he said, had turned up Ring security cameras, kitchen cabinets, countertops, astroturf, dining room chairs, paint, lumber, even big bags of charcoal. Up popped photographs of a discount wholesaler called Cost Less, followed by an article from the Orange County Register. In 2021, the newspaper reported that Facebook users had read about Cost Less's grand opening and couldn't wait to get inside. The store advertised overstocked merchandise at up to 80% off. Skechers for $15, Uggs for $79. During the pandemic, the newspaper reported, Cost Less's inventory of pantry goods and cleaning supplies became an alternative when traditional stores sold out. An employee bragged that the owner refused to charge more for pandemic supplies such as Lysol spray and Clorox, even when he lost money. The store became part of a broader investigation involving more than $50 million worth of boosted freight, including Samsung and Sony televisions. The ring behind these thefts allegedly stole 5 to 7 tractor trailers per week, sometimes by posing as truck drivers. Investigators impounded $500,000 in cash, 13 gold bars, and numerous illegal firearms. 40 people were arrested. As Eberhard showed me the photographs, he marveled at $1 energy drinks and $10 packages of pistachios, which, even at Costco, sell for more than double that amount. It's crazy, he said. On the afternoon of September 2, 2022, a man walked into a Macy's in Valencia and asked to see a gold chain. A clerk behind a glass case pulled out a piece that cost more than $4,200. The customer snatched the necklace from her hand and ran. About an hour later, he showed up at a Macy's in Redondo Beach and did the same thing, taking a chain worth more than $2,000. Over the next few days, he robbed Macy's stores in Lakewood, Montebello, and Santa Ana, stealing chains that collectively were worth nearly $20,000. In each instance, the thief wore a face mask, a baseball cap, a white tank top, and dark basketball shorts trimmed in white. In later heists, his outfit included red and black shorts, a long-sleeved shirt that snugly fit his athletic frame, and a series of caps, one emblazoned with positive state of mind. At one jewelry counter, he admired himself in a mirror before sprinting out wearing a chain that the clerk had made the mistake of fastening around his neck. The man always ran to the passenger side of a getaway car, a silver Lexus sedan with distinctive dents on the back right bumper and near the driver's door. The presence of an accomplice qualified the thefts as organized retail crime, as did the possibility that the jewelry was going to a fence. As is typical, the suspects were engaged in multiple types of offenses. The getaway car once waited in a handicapped zone and sped off the wrong direction down a one-way street. On Halloween 2022, it struck a sheriff's deputy who had been chasing the suspect on foot, injuring the officer's leg and arm. The car made no attempt to go around him, according to a deputy who witnessed the hit and run. The crimes also involved fraud, as the jewelry thief presented a fake ID, including a Tennessee driver's license and a California medical marijuana card belonging to the other man. And there was destruction of property. The thief broke one chain in half during an altercation with a clerk. His behavior suggested he did not mind overpowering others in order to get what he wanted. After he hit three stores in one day, K Jewelers notified employees, "Do not attempt to chase or physically engage the suspect." The man's most distinctive physical feature was his array of tattoos. Karen over his left eyebrow, a red crown on his neck. Store employees remembered seeing a cross tattoo on his left arm and on the inside of his wrists an umbrella and a spider. The organized retail crime unit called him the Karen Bandit. By November, the bandit had stolen $40,000 worth of jewelry from Macy's and another $80,000 worth from JCPenney. The case involved police reports, witness statements, forensic evidence, voluminous security footage, and surveillance. The lead detective on the case, Scott Elson, found that the bandit was covering his tracks with another form of fraud. Someone was cold-plating the Lexus by using a license plate registered to another vehicle. Detectives traced the bandit to a one-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles and two of the stolen gold chains to a local pawn shop. They also had a suspect for the getaway car. In the pawn shop's sales records, Elson noticed what he thought was an error. The suspected driver's name was supposed to be spelled with an A, not an E. Then he saw the notation, "Twin Brothers." He was dealing with two potential accomplices with virtually the same name and the exact same DNA. In driver's license photographs, the twins shared the same goatee, ear piercings, and haircut. Elson couldn't get enough on the brothers to charge them, but the Karen bandit pleaded guilty and is serving 8 years in prison. To Eberhardt, the surprise twist in the roster of potential co-conspirators underscored the shape-shifting nature of organized retail crime. He explained, "It's never one thing." Retailers are insured against loss, but they and law enforcement officers like to point out that organized retail crime is not victimless. To start, there are humans on the other end of hostile encounters. In the Karen Bandit case, numerous employees, Vanessa, Renee, Monica, Miriam, Nathan, Hannah, Anna, Valerie, had to weigh the risk of injury or unemployment, or worse, against the act of showing a customer a nice necklace. The NRF recently reported that 8 out of 10 U.S. retailers say that thieves have become more aggressive and violent. In one shocking case in Hillsboro, North Carolina, a man pushing a cartload of power washers out of a Home Depot shoved an 82-year-old employee to the concrete floor without breaking stride. The clerk, Gary Razor, died of complications from the fall, and the state medical examiner ruled his death a homicide. Reportedly, Razor had merely asked for a receipt. Last year, at a Home Depot near San Francisco, Blake Mose, an LP who hoped to become a police officer, confronted a woman about an item taken from the power tools department. She pulled a gun from her purse and shot him in the chest. She later claimed it went off by accident. Mose's colleagues wore their orange work aprons to his funeral. His mother, Lori, testifying at a congressional hearing, blamed the criminal justice system, Home Depot, and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, alleging that the agency had failed to make safety a priority for LPs. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, more than 15 million people work in the retail sector. The NRF says that retail supports 52 million American jobs. If retailers hope to recruit and retain good employees, they must first keep them safe. Companies have started to use security robots that relay alerts to guards and systems for advanced weapon detection. During blitzes, Eberhardt and his officers often find handguns tucked into suspects' waistbands. Retailers also want to improve their analytic and investigative skills, according to the NRF. When I asked Duryea, the CHP commissioner, whether he worries that law enforcement's collaboration with private industry will create a class of para-police retail workers, he said no, and told me that employees are given rules of engagement. He said, "There's no commodity. We don't care how much it's worth. It's worth a human life." On store shelves today, even the insurers locked up, along with toothbrushes and socks. During the Home Depot blitz, one man forced open a cage housing Milwaukee power tools. Rodriguez radioed for someone to get eyes. Cap replied, "Yeah, I'm on him." That fellow ended up walking out empty-handed, as did a man who ditched a full cart near the entrance. Eberhardt and I watched him beat it in a gold Mitsubishi. "Got spooked," someone said. Just before closing, an older man arrived in a khaki jacket and a nice plaid shirt, looking like he might have come from a Lakers game. The LPs recognized him as a booster who liked to taunt employees, knowing that they're not allowed to stop him from stealing. When the man pushed a cart with large boxes through the front door, a detective radioed, "Good for a takedown." Outside, the man was handcuffed and told to stay put. "Where am I going to go?" he huffed. A check of his fingerprints showed that he was wanted on more than $200,000 worth of warrants for charges ranging from petty theft to making criminal threats. An LP walked over to Eberhardt and said, "Today I would call a good day." Back in the RAM, Eberhardt told me, "That's why it's such a nice thing to have these asset protection people. They know their clientele. They know their habitual offenders." The blitz ultimately ensnared survival shoplifters and organized retail crime suspects in nearly equal measure. A fellow in an McLovin t-shirt was caught with two cans of bear paint and multiple bottles of Green Gobbler Drain Clog Dissolver. A wiry older man just shook his head when found taking toilet paper, laundry detergent, and paper towels. Petty larceny did not interest the detectives, but, as Eberhard put it, a misdemeanor is a misdemeanor, a theft is a theft. You can't pick and choose what you want to enforce. The impounded evidence included an illegal fixed-blade knife found in the right front pocket of a young man who had arrived on a Razor scooter. Later at the operations debriefing, Probart told the squad, "Only one guy with a weapon this time." This by Paige Williams. She began writing for The New Yorker in 2013 and became a staff writer in 2015. She is the author of The Dinosaur Artist, which was named a Times Notable Book of 2018. My next article is about art. I realize that art is a difficult subject for a visually impaired audience, but this discussion is very much about aesthetics and nature and life. Perhaps these discussions are more about the world around us than what some of us see with our eyes. This is Gustav Klimt's Hunger to Please. The art of Gustav Klimt makes me feel as though I'm face to face with God. If God is a charming, faintly trashy type who leers more than he enlightens and seems oddly desperate for my approval. Klimt's mysticism is a kind of busy stagecraft, all confetti cannons and angels dangling from ropes. It drove people wild 125 years ago and still does, though a closer look at his path from academic painter to Viennese radical to professional heiress glorifier suggests a man stuck between 19th and 20th century attitudes, and all the more fascinating for it. In a photograph taken around 1908, a decade before his death, he wears a floor-length smock and points his big wolfish head at the darkness, arms crossed. He looks like a crook disguised as a priest, the better to get his way. A version of the smock and many of the paintings he finished while wearing it can be found at Klimt Landscapes at the Neue Gallery's second major show since closing for renovations last summer. The theme is a head-scratcher. Who thinks of Klimt with his gold leaf and gorgeous women as a painter of nature? Only a small fraction of the works here qualify as landscapes, and many of these were completed toward the end of Klimt's life when he was between portraits of wealthy sitters, simmering in the Austrian countryside, and, the show stresses this point, painting for his own pleasure. When artists create for themselves, we tend to assume that the results are more personal. But the rule seems iffier in the case of this taciturn yet resolutely public figure who may have been most himself when he had spectators and a trunk full of props to wow them with. He was born in 1862 in the village of Baumgarten. Gold was in his blood. His father was a skilled engraver of it, but the family was always on the brink of poverty. As a scholarship kid at Vienna's School of Arts and Crafts, Klimt impressed his teachers and prepared for a life spent painting big, history-burnishing murals for the Austro-Hungarian Empire. A scarily perfect drawing of a male nude, done the year he turned 18, suggests both the conventional career that was his for the taking and, in subtler ways, the one he took. The figure, which has been outlined with great care and shaded into lifelikeness, reclines on a bed, but since the bed is more crudely drawn than the rest, he almost seems to be drifting through nothingness. It's hard to say if his right leg is tensed or slack, if this is a pose or the absence of one. Few aesthetic movements, interesting ones anyway, can be neatly defined. With the Vienna Secession, the esteemed group that Klimt co-founded in 1897, it's especially futile. There was no single manifesto, and the entire thing was in pieces in less than a decade. The historian Karl Skorsch, in his definitive Fin de Siècle Vienna, described the secession as an Oedipal snarl, loud but brief, at an older generation of prudes and pedants. It was radical in some ways, and enriched Viennese art with a new sexual frankness and proto-modernist flatness. But it also enjoyed support from the liberal Austrian government for a while, and even accepted commissions. How avant-garde, really, is a group that designs postage stamps? If you knew nothing about the secession and had only Klimt to consult, you might guess that it was about hair. Whether they depict the stuff or not, his pictures seem to aspire to hair's condition, weightless, undulating, at once realistic and abstract. Take a wispy drawing from around 1901 of a woman in profile. Notice first how much the drawer has unlearned, having mastered the realistic depiction of flesh in his teens. He needed something new. And second, how plain the woman's head looks compared with what's growing out of it. In Klimt's other work of this era, little is straight and absolutely nothing is heavy, least of all when it's coated in gold. Bright patterns float around bodies, and the bodies flow into each other, liquid even when they're solid. Does this sound a little silly? It is. When Klimt tries to distort shapes that are too stubbornly fleshy. The enormous thigh in the female nude Danae, say, which looks like a thigh, a phallus, and a body rolled into one. Other pictures have a green screen phoniness. When a woman thrashes around in colorful geometric quicksand, you sense that she's just play-acting for her director. T.J. Clark, the most eloquent Klimt hater, thought he specialized in the new century's pretend difficulty and opacity, pretend mystery and profundity, pretend eroticism and excess. His art is, sure enough, humorless, albeit in a teenage way that is kind of funny. What's teenage about it is the combination of squirming lust with an awkwardness masked by bravado, about where to go from there. On rare occasions when a man and a woman meet in these paintings, there may be a flurry of loud shapes, but never anything resembling an erotic spark. Art perhaps echoes life. Klimt reportedly fathered 14 children, but was said to be quite shy. The kiss is supposed to be an image of two lovers embracing. Having spent some time with Noy's small, co-type version from a series produced between 1908 and 1914, I would call it an image of two heads orbited by a shoulder, some hands, some feet, and an elbow. Not that all Klimt's work lacks passion. It was a pleasant shock to find that his pictures of women are still genuinely sexy, although the word genuine is probably beside the point when we're talking about desire. With apologies to Clark, isn't all eroticism pretend? A second shock is that these pictures' sexiness doesn't come from the places you might expect. The erogenous zones aren't breasts or buttocks or even hair. Mouths and lazily narrowed eyes bring the real heat. Savor both in a colotype of Judith the First, wherein the beautiful widow almost caresses the head of Holofernes, which, to go by the biblical tale, she has just separated from his body. Now compare with the brow-clenching, sword-gripping version painted by Caravaggio. I'm not sure I can imagine Klimt's Judith holding onto a weapon, let alone using one, but I still wouldn't want to cross her. If she looks relaxed, it's only because her power is total. Holofernes has already been slain and then sliced again for good measure by the picture's right edge. This time the solemnity doesn't verge on silliness. It pushes all the way through to new territory. Klimt abstracts without sacrificing his academy-trained eye for the particular, and the result is a breathtaking blinking woman who is also a force of nature. Which brings us at last to the landscapes. I've left them for the end, both because Noyet mostly does, and because they're far from his most exciting pictures. Their signature motif, going simply by area, is a pointless carpet of colors, which may signal a cluster of pear trees or a watery reflection a la Monet. But the brightness and flatness that Monet relished for their own sake, Klimt can't leave alone. Patches of background keep popping up to decode the space, as though abstraction requires some explanation. John Updike wrote that Klimt sought to banish perspectival depth. Not quite. It's more like he wants to make it disappear in order to conjure it back to ooze and gasps. In Forrester's house in Wiesenbach II, Garden, of 1914, you can see straight through one of the windows to the other side of the building. It's a witty little detail, but it leaves an aftertaste of insecurity. Klimt, reminding some imaginary beholder, or maybe just himself, that he's only pretending to paint in a flat matter. He was at least consistent. Even Klimt's landscapes are dazzling, almost nourishing portraits of a maiden half buried in the picture plane, the maiden being Mother Nature. The traditionalism of Viennese art may have held him back, but so did his own hunger to please. He challenged audiences, but not too much. That's better than most of us manage, of course. And who could begrudge him some pretty paintings to remember summer by? At the Neue, they're the finale of a four-decade extravaganza in which a talented artist removes layer after layer of training, but instead of getting down to the raw and essentials, he finds himself fully clothed. This by Jackson Arne, the New Yorker's art critic. And that's all we have time for today. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This has been the New Yorker Hour. I'll be back with you again next week. Till then, take care, stay safe, and be well. Bye-bye.